Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, April 24, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our topic is encryption, the Heartbleed bug, and more. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear from three experts today, including our guest moderator. Our experts are Chris Segoyan. He is Principal Technologist and Senior Policy Analyst in the Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project of the American Civil Liberties Union. We'll also hear from repeat guest Paul Rosenzweig. He's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and he's principal at Red Branch Law and Consulting. And our guest moderator today is not only the chairman of our International Law and National Security Practice Group, he is a partner at the Seiger Gefeller Lurie Law Firm in New York. With that, and his name is Vince Witkowski, I should say, but with that, Mr. Witkowski, please go right ahead with the program.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you for hosting this call. Good afternoon. The recently discovered Heartbleed bug is a coding error in a widely used encryption software. It's a vulnerability that can lead to the disclosure of user names, passwords, and encryption keys. In some cases, it can be used to intercept information in communications stored on or sent from compromised sites, and it's believed to implicate two-thirds of the servers on the Internet. Now, a previously undiscovered bug is called a zero-day vulnerability, and its use is called a zero-day exploit. Earlier this month, Bloomberg News reported that the NSA knew about the Heartbleed bug for at least 2 years and regularly used it to gather intelligence. The NSA has denied that report, but whether or not it knew about this specific vulnerability, the scenario is a part of a recurring dilemma. The NSA has two missions: spying on foreign networks and protecting critical U.S. networks. Like its foreign counterparts, the NSA engineers or discovers or purchases zero-day bugs. When it does, it has to make a choice. Does it disclose the bug and allow it to be patched, or does it store and exploit it? Now, with all the attention on the NSA in the last year, this particular set of issues hasn't received much public discussion. They were addressed by the President's Review Group on Intelligence and Communication Technologies, which made some recommendations, and we'll use those as a framework for today's call. Here's the first. In Recommendation 30, the review group said, U.S. policy should generally move to ensure that 0 days are quickly blocked so that the underlying vulnerabilities are patched on U.S. government and other networks. In rare instances, U.S. policy may briefly authorize using a zero-day for high-priority intelligence collection following senior interagency review involving all appropriate departments. To kick off the discussion on this subject, we're going to turn to Chris.
So thank you all for inviting me here. It's really exciting to be able to discuss this topic finally with some legal experts. I think first it's exciting that we've even gotten to the point where the White House is acknowledging that they are using 0 days. It's great that we've gotten to the point that they acknowledge that they have a policy. However, the policy that they've announced is essentially riddled with loopholes. There are two main loopholes that I see in the policy that has been announced. The first is that it really seems to focus on the vulnerabilities that are discovered by the U.S. government, which, at least based on the phrasing of the statement put out by the White House, would appear to exclude vulnerabilities that are purchased by the U.S. government. And so there are, of course, NSA employees who find vulnerabilities, but there are also tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars spent every year by the NSA, by the CIA, by JSOC, by the FBI, by the DEA, by other agencies to acquire 0 days sold to them by Beltway bandits like Raytheon, like Harris, like Mantech. And the policy really sort of glosses over that issue. It would, of course, be foolish for the NSA to spend $1 million buying an iOS vulnerability from the Harris Corporation, only to then turn around and give it to Apple the next day. I think it would probably be considered a waste of taxpayer dollars. There really, for now, it isn't much confirmation or discussion or insight into what the policies are regarding the purchase of zero days, which I definitely think needs to take place. The other big loophole, of course, is this statement that that this policy doesn't apply unless there is, quote, a clear national security or law enforcement need. But of course, there's always a national security or law enforcement need justifying the vulnerabilities that they are discovering, weaponizing, and putting into use. If there were not a national security or law enforcement need, they wouldn't be using them in the first place. I also think that, look, I expect the NSA to use zero days. That's, you know, that's why they are in business. But I think it's a really slippery slope for law enforcement agencies to start using these. I think it's, you know, it starts with the FBI, and then it goes down to the DEA, to the U.S. Marshal Service, to Customs and ICE, and then it trickles down to local law enforcement agencies, probably starting with the NYPD, and eventually you have, you know, Joe Arpaio in Arizona with a stockpile of ODAs that he simply cannot be trusted with. And these tools are so powerful, and the collateral damage associated with their use by the government is so staggering that we really need to have a clear public debate about the use by the government of these things, the stockpiling. Of course, the time to buy or find a zero day is not when you need to use it, right? You don't go out on the market and try and buy one, you know, 10 minutes before you need to use it. You need to have these things sitting around ready to go when you discover that, you know, Vladimir Putin just bought a new iPhone, or that, you know, the German chancellor just upgraded her computer to Windows 8. You need to have these things ready to go. You need to have one for every conceivable operating system. You need to have multiple vulnerabilities in case others get popped, get discovered by researchers. You need to have multiple vulnerabilities even when they don't get discovered, because you don't want to use the same vulnerability in different operations, because then you provide linkability. You know, even if your identity is not known, whoever later comes across that information will learn that the person who hacked into the Chinese government system was the same person who hacked into the Iranian government system. And so what that means is that government agencies have this incentive to stockpile a huge number of vulnerabilities, and they are constantly buying them because they never know how long they'll last. We see that the way they buy these things is structured towards making sure they don't get disclosed. You know, anecdotal evidence that I've gotten from people who are in this industry suggests that the purchase agreements that they sign, you know, you will, let's say you get paid $100,000 for an O-Day, you won't get it all in one go. You'll get, you know, 25% on day one, and then you'll get another three payments, you know, over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months. And if the vulnerability is discovered by someone else, or you know, Microsoft figures out what it is and releases a patch, you stop getting paid, right? So the payments are structured to incentivize non-disclosure, to incentivize continued vulnerability. And what that means then is, if we have these government agencies that are buying these things and sitting on them and stockpiling them, they only really work if the rest of us are kept vulnerable. Microsoft doesn't release a patch for Americans, but not for Mexicans or Iranians. Everyone in the world gets the same patches from Google and Apple and Microsoft. And so it puts us in this strange situation where U.S. intelligence, military, and law enforcement agencies are sitting on information that, if it were revealed, would make us more safe. And I think that really I think that's something that has taken place without any public debate. There haven't been any congressional hearings on the use of zero days or the purchase of zero days. To the extent that there has been a large debate about cybersecurity in the last few years in D.C., it's really been in the context of the U.S. as the victim, and the U.S. government doing everything they can to protect U.S. individuals and companies and U.S. government agencies. And I don't think the public has really been told the real story, which is that the U.S. government in many cases is making things worse, that the U.S. government has fed and legitimized this market, and that that U.S. government agencies are in fact paying money through deals that are specifically structured to keep computer systems vulnerable for as long as possible. And so I really think it's good that we're having this debate. It's good that the White House is now announcing a policy. But I do think this is a debate that needs to move to Congress. And I think we really need to start acknowledging what the consequences of these kinds of programs are.
Well, this is Paul. I guess I'll jump in here. As a descriptive matter, I think I agree with almost everything that Chris has said in terms of describing the market. I think that the challenge is in how that description should guide American policy. For example, consequence of that analysis might be to prohibit the use of 0 days altogether by the federal government. I take it that not even Chris would suggest that was a bad idea. Certainly the Presidential Review Board didn't, because at some fundamental level, they're an essential component of affirmative national security activity. The reference to Sheriff Joe Arapio kind of made me wonder whether or not we might think about prohibiting subunits of the government, because nothing stops Arapio from buying his own 0 days right now, or regulating their use in some way. The challenge that comes from that, of course, is that whatever policy we wind up adopting in the United States is almost certainly not going to be mirrored by other nations. We may very well choose to self-limit our use of 0 days, prohibit subunits from using 0 days, prohibit private corporations from using 0 days or purchasing them on the open market, mandate their disclosure when discovered. There are all sorts of possibilities out there. Very, very few of those are likely to be adopted by Russia, China, and other peer competitor nations who act in the cyber conflict space. So that kind of raises the question of efficacy of an American policy. And there are probably two pieces to that that we should put on the table for further discussion. The first of those is that the supply of 0 days is, for all intents and purposes, infinite. Now, there's no way to corner the market on this. They are as broad as the code in new applications, and every time a new piece of software is produced, the possibility of new 0 days follows along. So the idea that a U.S. policy of discovering them all and disclosing them all and making the world generally safer through that mechanism is simply not going to be a policy that we can be confident would be successful. In other words, to put it another way, there is a non-zero number of 0 days that will be discovered by our enemies that we won't be aware of. And so we can't expect that our unilateral decisions will affect the entire marketplace. That leads me to the kind of the second piece of the puzzle, or the second way that I approach it, which is that you need some theory, some policy, to describe which 0 days we will keep secret and use for offensive purposes, and which 0 days we will, if we discover them or if we purchase them, disclose for defensive purposes and the hardening of American infrastructure, for example. And that's a difficult question, because the right answer, it seems to me, really depends upon our own self-analysis of our own capabilities, a differential analysis of how much better or worse the Russians and Chinese and Iranians are at discovering these vulnerabilities, a detailed analysis of which
which systems are particular vulnerabilities for us versus which systems are particular vulnerabilities for people that we might want to use the exploits against. So we talk, for example, Chris mentioned Windows 8. Windows 8 is so pervasive in American systems that for that we would probably want to lean into disclosure to protect America. But there are other systems, operating systems in particular, where the vulnerability might be exclusively overseas or predominantly overseas, where purchasing it, keeping it confidential, and stockpiling it would be the right decision. So I agree with what I think is implicit in what Chris said, which is that the White House's statement of policy is a non-limiting statement. It essentially identifies two exceptions, and I accept as a premise that at least that we are agreed that the national security exemption is a useful one, and maybe we could disagree about the law enforcement one, but I think it's a de minimis aspect of the field right now. The real hard part is defining the policy that underlies it and making the value judgment of when U.S. national security interest is best served by keeping a zero-day confidential, purchasing it or creating it, and keeping it confidential for future exploit, and under what circumstances the opposite of that is true. It's really, frankly, a game theory kind of analysis that requires a great deal of intricacy and is almost certainly different for virtually every zero day we discover and virtually every operating system we address. Which leads me to the last point before I'll turn it back to you, Vince, which is that because I tend to think that the question is very much premised on a detailed analysis of particularized applications of zero days and particular exploits and the particular vulnerabilities in foreign and American systems, I tend to think that congressional engagement is welcome. I never disagree, but isn't going to advance the ball very far. Because unless the Congress is going to prohibit all zero-day use by America or authorize it with exceptions or prohibit it with some exceptions, the devil is always going to be in the application details and the underlying more narrowly drawn decisions about specific zero-day possibilities at specific times and places.
If I can just quickly respond to one thing you said, Paul. So I think you're wrong as a sort of technical manner to assume that there are essentially unlimited number of zero days. I think, and there are two sort of interesting data points that I want to bring up. So the first is that the prices paid for O-days on the market is not the same across the board. So the price for a vulnerability in the iOS operating system is not the same as a vulnerability in Firefox. For two different web browsers, the Google Chrome browser and the Mozilla Firefox browser, the prices on the market are different. And I think that reflects the fact that Chrome is a more secure product that is much more difficult to attack it. And if you see, I mean, we only have partial information, right? We have this anecdotal information about the prices that are being paid through these shady middlemen. And then we also have the prices that are being paid by the companies who offer bounties in their own products. And we can see the bugs that are being turned in by responsible researchers who are, competing in these contests like the Ponium contest that Google offers. So I think one really interesting point here, if you look a couple of years ago, Google had a Ponium contest. They've done it since, but one of the most interesting write-ups comes from 2012. And the two biggest payouts at Ponium in May of 2012, one was to a researcher named Pinkie Pie, who was able to who was able to do remote code execution on Chrome, and his successful attack leveraged six vulnerabilities tied together in a chain. The other guy who got a big payout was Sergey Glazunov, who tied 10 bugs together in a chain. And so what we're seeing, because the browser vendors and some of the operating system providers have started to build highly secure features like sandboxes into their products, typically a single O-Day doesn't get you anywhere anymore. To deliver malicious code to a user using Chrome or Safari or IE at this point, you need to tie a bunch of things together. And that pushes the cost up. And it's not a coincidence that, you know, Chrome is seen as the most secure browser, that iOS is seen as the most secure mobile operating system. It's not a coincidence that Firefox vulnerabilities and Flash vulnerabilities are worth less on the market because they are less secure products. And I actually do think that there are I think that zero days in software like Chrome are scarce. It is a difficult thing to land a remote execution payload to one of these products, and it takes a lot of time. And so I think if the U.S. government were to do the right thing and to focus on prioritizing defense over offense, I think they could significantly disrupt the market. I think it's also important to note that to the extent that the U.S. government is present in this market, it is present solely in the form of an offensive adversary and not one of a defensive adversary. You know, we spend $80 million a year just in DHS R&D money in cyber. There are billions a year spent on cybersecurity by the U.S. government, but we are not buying vulnerabilities and taking them off the market to fix them. We are just buying them to exploit them. I also think that at a higher level, that we haven't had an honest debate. The debate over cybersecurity has really focused on many sideshow issues, like information sharing, which I think is really silly, but it's an issue that lawyers can wrap their heads around, and so that's where the focus of the debate has been. You know, we haven't been honest as a country about what the U.S. government does in the area of cybersecurity and the fact that the U.S. government in many ways is making things worse. And I think that's because it's not a particularly pleasant story to tell. And I think it's also difficult to scare your population into believing that we are facing a grave threat when the facts are that we are, in fact, exploiting things and making things a lot worse. And on the point of Congress, I also differ there. I do think it's important for legislators to take responsibility for this stuff. I think if Congress had held open committee hearings, if members had voted for explicit authorization that permitted the stockpiling and use of zero days, I think we'd be having a very different debate. But instead, law enforcement, intelligence, and military agencies have sort of creeped into this space without there being any accountability. And you know, to the extent that this is something that, you know, the Federalist Society cares about, I also think it's just really messed up that, you know, U.S. companies are putting millions of dollars into building secure software. They are competing in a global market on the reputation of their products. And one of the main things that wins them or loses business is the security of their products. And they are now essentially competing with their own government, to keep their products secure. The U.S. government is now the biggest threat faced by many of the companies in the information security space. And I think that's wrong. I think the government should be there to help businesses, not to attack businesses. You know, we all gain when data is secure, and I think, you know, this is not the right approach, but it's one that has been allowed to happen because it's happened under the cloak of secrecy.
Well, we should probably let Vince wrap this up, and I'm certainly not going to disagree with you that the security of different programs is variable, and that, you know, iOS is more secure than Windows, and that Chrome is more secure than Firefox. I, however, would suggest, and I've actually read some of the studies out of the folks at MIT and Carnegie Mellon, that it's theoretically impossible to guarantee that there are no further bugs to be discovered in code. That the idea is that you cannot be sure that all code bugs are gone. And so long as that's the case, it seems to me that we're not, that the idea of collecting all of them or banning all of them is not going to be a feasible approach to policymaking that we really have to think about which ones we collect and what we use them for in terms of our own best interests. I do agree with you completely, though, that what is lacking inside the executive branch, and perhaps with congressional input, but you're much more sanguine about their capabilities than I am, is any kind of internal process that examines the 0 days that we collect and says, this one for offense, this one, it would be better if we told all of the current operators of SCADA systems on the electric grid about, because they should, we bought it, and if the Russians have this, this is much worse for South Dakota than it would be for Sevastopol. And I think we're in a complete agreement that there ought to be a process of making that determination at some point or another. Vince?
Yeah, thanks. A key.
I know we're running too much, right?
A key element of network security, information security, is encryption. And here's what the review board had to say about that. We recommend that regarding encryption, the U.S. government should, one, fully support and not undermine efforts to create encryption standards. Two, not in any way subvert, undermine, weaken, or make vulnerable generally available commercial software. And three, increase the use of encryption and urge U.S. companies to do so in order to better protect data in transit, at rest, in the cloud, and in other storage. Paul, what are your thoughts?
Well, this one it may be shorter because I suspect that there's not much distance between Chris and I on this one. Of all of the allegations that have been made against the NSA, the one that most troubles me, if true, and I don't necessarily assume that everything that Edward Snowden has disclosed is contextually reported in an accurate manner, would be the idea of the NSA using its privileged position as one of the creators of encryption standards to purposefully put in place standards that it knows it can break. I get the idea that the NSA is all about breaking encryption codes, and I certainly think that we should encourage as much as possible their expansion of capabilities to do that as part of their foreign intelligence mission. But if that's what we're focusing on as their work, then they should have little or no role in creating the standards in the first place, which are, if the vulnerability is created, then open to, deliberately created, that is, then open to general exploit around the globe by other cryptographers who are working at cracking the code. Now, I have to confess that at this point, the science of cryptography sometimes eludes me, and the description of the sophistication of the vulnerabilities suggests that they are available only to a very limited number of people, and that the NSA might reasonably have thought that some of the vulnerabilities that it was permitting to be placed in encryption standards for ones that only it could take advantage of. But that, it strikes me, as is fundamentally short-sighted, because even if true today, it is unlikely to remain true over the near to mid-term as other people's capabilities for code breaking improve. As for the propagation of encryption as an encouraged standard, I think we, in the conservative regime, should be free marketists. I think that it's absurd to prohibit people from using encryption. It's perfectly fine for anybody to buy whatever encryption product they want to use and implement. I recognize full well that that means that there will ultimately be some communications that the NSA and or the FBI cannot decrypt. And again, I tend to think that it's kind of fruitless to say America ought not to have strong encryption as a way of empowering the NSA, because in the end, we're going to wind up with other people creating that encryption as well. And so our own communications will be vulnerable because we don't use the strongest possible encryption, but other communications will gradually become impenetrable to us, which is a formula for disaster. And the final point I would make, which is really just a realpolitik one, is that encryption is generally pretty well available right now in a lot of forms, and almost nobody uses it, which is a an oddity of the debate that we have, is that the average American and even the average criminal doesn't use it. In the last report on wiretaps that the FBI did, I think they reported that exactly six of the intercepted conversations that they had encountered were encrypted, and that all the other ones that they had gotten Title III wiretaps to listen in on were happening in the clear. And likewise, I have had a PGP, a pretty good privacy encryption key, for a half dozen years now, and I think I have gotten exactly one encrypted PGP message, which was somebody testing to see if it worked. So the propagation of encryption and its availability is not, it needs to be accompanied, if it's going to actually change individual security on the network, by educational efforts. Chris?
So there are a few points I think that are useful to mention here. So the first is a very high level one, which is that, in the wake of the initial Snowden disclosures, the response from the administration was, what the NSA has been doing has been subject to vigorous internal NSA oversight, congressional oversight, and judicial oversight. And reasonable people can quibble about the extent to which the FISA court, performed thoroughly independent analysis of what the NSA was doing, but the FISA court did sign off on the Section 215 program, and the FISA court has a more limited role in the 702 program, but, they provided some supervision of that. What the NSA does when it comes to the exploitation of vulnerabilities, the insertion of vulnerabilities, the distortion and twisting of cryptographic standards, the bribing and extortion of U.S. companies to insert flaws into their products, that all happens in an oversight-free world. There is no judicial review of that stuff. There is, I suspect, minimal to no congressional review, and I suspect that that stuff really doesn't make its way into the senior principal discussions that take place in the White House, except in the case, where a U.S. company finds out about it and then gets really angry, right? So a few weeks back, when Facebook learned that the NSA had impersonated Facebook servers to their users and used an impersonation of Facebook's servers to deliver malware to people, Mark Zuckerberg called up the president and was very upset. And I imagine that there were some frantic telephone calls between the National Security Council staff and folks at Fort Meade shortly after that happened. But typically, I suspect that these are decisions that are taking place solely within offices at NSA and JSOC and the CIA, and are not being made by people who are ultimately politically accountable. And so I think, the stuff that NSA is doing that is the most destructive to the security of this country and to the security, to the longevity of U.S. businesses, is stuff that is really taking place in an oversight-free world. That's the first point. Second one is I think that many people are now understanding that when you work with the U.S. government, with a U.S. government agency, you may be working with the good guys or the bad guys, or both. I think that people at NIST thought that they were getting input from the good guys at NSA, the people who are defensive, but in fact they were getting misinformation or information that was not helpful from the offensive side. The chairman of RSA gave a speech in February in which he basically said that, his company had been duped, that they thought that they were working with the side of NSA that was working to make things better, when in fact it had been the part of NSA that in fact makes things worse, to subvert the cryptography. And this even takes place in other agencies. There was a great article in Foreign Policy last November by Matthew Aid, the NSA historian, in which he said that the FBI has a collection of architectural drawings, floor plans, and building permits of most of the embassies in Washington, D.C., and the FBI uses these to then conduct intelligence operations to break into the embassies and steal cryptographic keys and secrets from the embassies. The way that the FBI gets these drawings is from the State Department diplomatic security staff. The State Department is supposed to provide physical protection to embassies. That's part of their mandate. But of course, you know, you give the blueprints to the State Department and they turn around and give them to the people who are going to use that information to steal information. I think many people are realizing now that, you know, when you talk to someone from NSA or the State Department or NIST, you can never really be sure if the information that you're getting is to help or to exploit. And I think that, you know, NSA has done significant long-term harm to the reputation of NIST. I think NIST as a neutral convener of scientists and engineers, I think their reputation is done, and it will take a generation to come back, if it ever will come back. And I think that, you know, the White House Review Group, when they you know, wrote about this in their report, I think their statements were in fact full of loopholes too. So, for example, the White House Review Group in their report on page 217 says, quote, upon review, however, we are unaware of any vulnerability created by the U.S. government in generally available commercial software that puts users at risk of criminal hackers or foreign governments decrypting their data. That is not a blanket statement that there are no back doors that have been inserted in generally available commercial software. That just is a statement saying that whatever back doors exist, they don't think that other governments or criminals can exploit. And I think, again, we need to be honest about what's taking place. And I don't think NSA and their defenders have been entirely clear about what they do and how they do it. I'm not saying that they need to fess up with a list of vulnerabilities and backdoors they've snuck into software, but I do think that they need to acknowledge that this is one of the things that they do. And I do think there needs to be a robust oversight process for this. I don't think that the NSA knew about Heartbleed, but there are probably a dozen other vulnerabilities, both programming errors and intentionally inserted backdoors that NSA knows about in other products, including OpenSSL. And I think the denials that we got from the White House after the Heartbleed bug were very specific to one line of code and one exploitable vulnerability. Of course, the NSA is targeting things like OpenSSL. If they weren't, whoever is running the show there should be fired. But we need to have an acknowledgement about the fact that this is the kind of thing they do, and this needs to be pulled into a system of robust oversight that is just absent. We need something like the FISA court. We need the intelligence committees to actually be evaluating these issues. And, you know, we have this weird system where the congressional committees that have authority and responsibility for the internet industry, the Energy and Commerce Committees in the House and Senate, and the Judiciary Committees to a lesser extent, they have no real involvement in these NSA programs. It seems very weird that the committee that is responsible for the companies that are left holding the bag doesn't really have any say in what the NSA is doing. And I think one of the things we really need to think about is whether it's wise to have the Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Committees be the only ones who are really having a say, or whether the Energy and Commerce Committee, which really has the responsibility for this part of our economy and the companies who are affected by this stuff, whether they should be looking into these matters too.
Can I push back on this just a bit? I mean, as much for the purpose of creating a little bit of discussion or planting some seeds. I mean, you said a couple things there that strike me as kind of inconsistent on this. As you said, at one point we needed an acknowledgement from the NSA that they're inserting backdoors, and then you said, but of course they are. That's what we expect them to be doing. So, I agree with the second of those. Of course, NSA is seeking to exploit all forms of communication vulnerability. That's its job. Its job is also to protect American communications. So I'm not sure how much acknowledgement you want. I think I agree with you that there needs to be a management process of determination of when and where and how we go through the exploit process. But my word, I can't imagine a FISA court for exploits having the least bit of effectiveness on this. I mean, I read the opinions of the FISA court on the metadata program, and it's clear to me that at least to some degree, a lot of what is happening is that the judges don't actually understand the metadata program and how it operates at a technical level, much less asking them to understand OpenSSL and a Heartbleed bug or some other bug. They're qualified to make broad policy decisions of the sort that, you know, we've been talking about in the zero-day context, are also the exact same questions are contextualized here. Which vulnerabilities are should we exploit, and which ones should we disclose, and which ones, I guess, we would add in now, should we create for our own benefit? But I don't think the courts are going to have much to say about that. And again, I'm kind of skeptical of Congress as well. I do think that the missing piece here, from my perspective, was that NSA's policy on exploits was not at all sensitive to the economic effects that it would have on American companies. I agree with you completely there. But the only, institution of government that's likely to actually do an effective job of representing that would be some form of interagency discussion at which the Commerce Department, speaks up and says, we do $2 billion worth of code trade on a monthly basis. We've got a $40 billion cloud economy that's in Europe right now, all of which is at risk if you do this. That's the type of policy discussion that would, I agree, be worth having, but I can't really see much value in having the FISA court or a FISA exploit court be responsible for trying to weigh those values. Those are precisely the types of policy decisions that we give to the elected, and executive branch representatives at some point or another.
So let me tell you what I meant. Yes, people in the security community don't trust the NSA for the most part. Many of them didn't trust them pre-Snowden, and definitely post-Snowden, no one trusts the NSA. People like you who have worked in the U.S. government, who have had a clearance, who know how SIGINT works and understand how the NSA gets what they get. Of course, you know what the NSA does, but I think that many people in this town and the general public don't have an understanding of the extent to which the NSA will lie, cheat, and steal to get what they want. I think in the NSA's view, the ends justify the means, and the ends are SIGINT on everyone that is of use, and whatever they have to do along the way, so be it. The fact that NIST is required by statute to consult with NSA, I think that comes from an era when NSA was seen as a party that would provide information that would be of value to building secure systems. And now, of course, no one in their right mind would trust the input of NSA. Likewise, in recent history, and just as recently as last year, NSA was being seriously considered to be, the entity tasked with domestic cybersecurity. Of course, now no one in their right mind would give NSA an iota of responsibility for that, because they've shown that their offensive goals take priority over the defensive side. So I think it's important to call out NSA what they are. You cannot entrust the wolf to guard the sheep, and NSA truly, truly is a wolf. On the FISA court point, you're not going to find any disagreement with me that the FISA court lacks understanding of technology, or that Congress lacks understanding of technology. I think it's a pretty significant mistake and shame that not a single technical expert was appointed to the president's NSA review group. I think it's a disappointment that the PCLOB doesn't have a technologist on it as a presidentially appointed committee member. I think it's a shame that the PCLOB still doesn't have a chief technologist advising them. I think there's no way to perform effective oversight of these issues without technologists. But I think the solution then is for the PCLOB and for congressional committees and for the FISA court to hire expert technologists. In the same way that there is a debate taking place now and some kind of general consensus that there should be a public interest advocate with the appropriate clearances who can argue before the FISA court, I think it's equally important that we have skilled technical experts working for the court who can provide the judges with the information they need to then ask the right kinds of questions. And I think if we had a court that had the ability to ask the right questions and to understand the answers, then I think we could see them moving into a role where they were also providing some kind of oversight over these kinds of programs, like the exploitation of zero days and the insertion of backdoors that really fundamentally threaten the security of our entire communications network.
So, Vince, I know you had a third question, but we only got 15 minutes left. Maybe we go to the rest.
Right. You're absolutely right. It's been a robust discussion. We're going to point out that one of the recommendations was splitting the spying and the security functions of the NSA. I'll just point out that it appears to have been dismissed out of hand by the president, despite the discussion we've just heard. But what I'd like to do, Dean, is check the question board and make sure that if there are questions, there's time to address at least some of them.
We're in the midst of a bit of a technical problem here on my end, Vince. So if you want to continue the discussion momentarily, I think we can begin. Well, let me try now. Okay, we seem to have solved that. So if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like at this point, Vince, we have one question. If you'd like to join the queue for questions, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Should we take this first question, Vince? Or?
Sure.
All right. Stand by.
Hi there. Thanks for taking questions. You had commented about the fact that there are encryption solutions out there for consumers, but they don't seem to be getting wide use yet. Why do you suppose that is? I'm thinking, for example, of some solutions that I'm aware of that AT&T or Verizon might be offering or Motorola might be offering to customers, cell phone users, for example, and my impression is that those aren't getting a lot of use. What do we suppose are the explanations or reasons for that?
This is Paul. I'll give you my answer. I mean, the survey data I've seen suggests there's two simple answers: cost and ease of use. Until encryption is kind of an easy default mode where you just press a button and all of your calls or all of your email is encrypted and decryptable on the other end by somebody who you've shared an encryption key with, it won't work. But I've just kind of given the game away. For it, really good encryption to work, you have to have had a preset set of communications with the person you're going to talk to in an agreed upon method. So that means that there's a setup cost to it, that you've got to exchange PGP keys or you've got to agree to exchange encryption certificates that are Microsoft Outlook enabled or whatever. And that barrier just really stops people from giving it a lot of thought, and it makes it unuseful. The only people who really do it are people strongly invested in privacy, journalists, for example, who are operating in the Middle East, that sort of thing. Chris, you got any thoughts?
Yeah, there's I think three things I'll quickly mention. So the first is that there is a usability tax associated with encryption. It's conceptually very difficult for the average person to grasp concepts like public key cryptography, and the software typically has been made by geeks for geeks, and so it's very difficult to learn how to use. Typically, many encryption features are not built into the software that we use by default, and so people have to seek out this stuff. This isn't something that just comes out of the box turned on by default. It takes two to tango. And so, there are things you can encrypt your hard disk by yourself, but to have an encrypted email or encrypted message, both sides need to use it. And so that can be very difficult to convince your friends and colleagues and loved ones to use it. I think that many of the companies that provide us with our communications tools, particularly the telcos, have been in cahoots with the government for more than 100 years. You should never expect that Verizon or AT&T will give you a wiretap-proof communication service because they have a long, fruitful relationship with the government based on the regulatory authority that the FCC has over them, and also based on the hundreds of millions of dollars a year that they get in contracts from U.S. government agencies. It's just they are not going to be the thing that stands between you and the government. You know, I'll also note that, you know, this time last year, I could count the number of journalists who I'd communicated with encrypted email and encrypted message on a single hand and still have a few fingers left over. That has, of course, changed. In the last year, post the DOJ investigation of the Associated Press and post Snowden, every national security reporter worth their salt is now encrypting their emails, encrypting instant messages, encrypting their telephone calls. I think it is absolutely disgraceful that the legal community has not followed. We know that intelligence agencies are monitoring the communications of attorneys with their clients. We know, for example, that the Australian government spied on the communications of the Indonesian government with their U.S. attorneys. It is simply inexcusable that law firms, particularly national security law firms, are still not using encrypted email, encrypted voice, and encrypted text. Particularly, you know, $1,000 an hour lawyers who can pay people to do this for them are not using this, are not providing these tools to their clients. And I suspect that we will not see the national security bar and then the ABA move in that direction for some time. But lawyers will not do this until failure to do so is deemed to be, you know, negligence. But I really do think that it is really, really inexcusable that the legal community has been so slow to adopt these technologies.
Actually, let me just jump on that with two quick points. The first is wearing another hat, I sit on the District of Columbia's Bar of Legal Ethics, and one of the questions we've been noodling around with is whether or not it becomes at this point ethically mandatory for lawyers to begin using encryption because for the very reasons that Chris said. I certainly know that I try and convince my clients to use it, and usually it's the clients who have the difficulties of enablement. And then the other point I would make is that Chris made the point that the telcos are kind of subservient to the government. I think that's changing. And then the other thing that is a barrier to encryption is that many of the business models of the companies that provide you services are premised on their ability to read the traffic as it goes by as a means of creating ads and data mining for their own uses, you know, Facebook, Google, those types of people. So they're not going to like encrypted traffic any more than the federal government does for their own commercial reasons. So they're not going to make it easier either.
Vince, it's Dean. We've got one question pending. Should we take another question?
Sure.
Hi, my name is Devin Watkins. I was a software developer at Intel for the last decade or so, now a law student. My question is, there's a lot of hackers out there that have zero-day vulnerabilities that they found, and they would love to either give it back to the company and let them fix it or sell it back to the company, but they're kind of scared both legally and they want to be continue to be anonymous and not known who they are exactly. Do you think the government has a role perhaps in facilitating a safe way that people can return and inform the companies where their products have problems or sell the vulnerability back to the company?
So this is Chris. I think that is a spectacular question. There are some companies like Google and Facebook who have adopted, you know, responsible disclosure policies where they would basically say, if you find a flaw and you tell us in the right way, we pledge not only to give you a bounty, we pay to give you some money, but we also pledge to not sue you or turn you into the FBI. And you know, there's an unfortunate track record with big companies and small ones who are approached by researchers with information about a vulnerability in their own product to freak out and turn to their legal teams in order to suppress the public disclosure of this. So this has happened from companies like Cisco, Apple, some auto companies. One company that manufactures automotive keys, remote entry keys, last year. And this is really short-sighted on the company's part, because what happens is then researchers don't approach them anymore. They just go full disclosure and perhaps anonymously report the vulnerability to the public. Because of the use and abuse of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act by prosecutors over the last few years, I think there is a lot of concern about the extent to which the CFA can be used to go after researchers. I know I've spoken to so many researchers who, before they publish something, need to call in a private counsel or talk to EFF, talk to the general counsel of their universities. And security research is dangerous, legally dangerous right now, and it shouldn't be. And I think, in the same way that the antitrust division inside DOJ recently put out an advisory statement saying that there are no antitrust issues associated with companies sharing information about security issues, in the same way that the Treasury Department recently put out some documentation telling banks that they can have bank accounts for people selling marijuana in states where it's legal, I think it would be great to get an advisory opinion from CSIPs, the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section at DOJ, basically laying out the rules of the road for researchers who want to disclose vulnerabilities in the right way. And I think that, the U.S. government could do a lot of good to promote responsible disclosure by providing a clear, safe path for researchers to hand these things in the same way that, in cities and counties around the country, if you have a child that you want to, turn in for adoption, there are safe places, like churches, where you can turn in the child and not face any consequences. We need to do this in a right way that encourages people to do the right thing. And unfortunately, the government in many cases has been not a positive force in this front, and it'd be nice for that to change.
Yeah, Chris, I think you're a little overly focused on the government. Though they can prosecute, they tend to they've been unlikely prosecutors of security researchers with affirmative goodwill. I mean, not completely so, but unlikely. The bigger problem is corporations who react adversely. And, congratulations on going to law school. One of the things that I do pro bono is researchers who have such vulnerabilities can retain me as their free counsel, and I do the disclosure for them and protect their confidentiality. And, obviously I'd rather get paid for good legal work, but as part of contributing to the improvement of the ecosystem, I think that that's a perfectly, it's a pretty nice thing to do, and it's kind of interesting, keeps me abreast of some of the things. I confess I haven't had it used very often, but I'd like it to be more. Unfortunately, there's probably nobody on the call who's going to use it, but tell your friends, right, that they can call me.
Well, Vince, we don't have any further questions at this point. I don't know if you want to give each of the panelists a minute to wrap up. Or
sure, why don't we do that?
Chris, you want to go first, or shall I?
You can go first.
Well, look, I think it's been a great discussion. I appreciate the opportunity to come and chat. I think the dominant takeaway from me for this is my continued skepticism about the value of kind of judicial and legislative intervention, mostly on technical grounds. I think in the end, any blanket policy of keeping all 0 days and keeping all vulnerabilities and exploits for offensive use, or disclosing all for defensive use, is probably the wrong answer, and that the right answer lies in a more nuanced assessment on a pretty much case-by-case basis of what our own assessment of the utility of a particular vulnerability or exploit is, and whether or not it would do better for us. So my principal critiques of the NSA at this point would be that they haven't really engaged in that assessment in any systematic way, that they seem to think that everything is offensive in nature and not defensive. And I would hope that one of the outcomes of this process has been of the recent disclosures will be a change in some of those internal processes.
I mean, I agree partially with Paul. I mean, an administration that lacked the technical understanding to manage the rollout of a website, admittedly a very complex website, but I think, you know, the lesson from healthcare.gov is that the administration didn't have senior people in a position in policy positions who understood technology. The chief technical officer of the White House for the last two CIOs and CTOs have been lawyers, not technical people. And I think, you know, as long as we lack technical understanding in the senior echelons of power in the United States, we are not going to have the right decisions being made on critical issues like the exploitation of vulnerabilities. You know, the incentives right now are aligned when the people who are making the decisions and people briefing those making decisions are optimizing for offense. We are not going to see defense play much of a role there. And you know, I question Paul's belief that the Commerce Department can really provide that check in the interagency process, given that the Commerce Department is a massive consumer of signals intelligence in the context of its role, you know, negotiating treaties and negotiating with other governments on a whole host of trade issues. I just think that they have a fundamental bias on many fronts. You know, we really need to have someone representing the security of the internet, and the fact is that there is no agency, you know, with the possible exception of the FTC, that has a clear role focused on keeping things safe and secure. And unfortunately, the FTC has been really kept out of these issues because they don't have a mandate that extends into surveillance just in the consumer space. So I do think we're missing an actor in the government who can act as a proxy for privacy and security.
Vince Witkowski, a final thought?
No, over to you, Dean.
Well, thank you so much. This is Dean Reuter. Vince Witkowski, my special thanks to you for not only organizing this call, but moderating it. Thanks also to Paul Rosenzweig and Chris Segoyan. We certainly appreciate the conversation. And thanks to the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to our audience that our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow at noon. We'll be looking at mental capacity and capital punishment in a case named Hernandez versus Stevens, which follows the Supreme Court decision in Atkins. That's tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.